An hour away from Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Before that, at 9:30, it'll be Fight the Empire. Today, host Per Fograng interviews Zahir Wahab on the wretched state of Afghanistan and the incredible resilience of the common people. And then at 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints, a report from an international solidarity activist currently in the Gaza Strip. Ali Abunima of the Electronic Intifada discusses a peace proposal being floated by Hamas, and the director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network talks about the politics of immigration in the U.S. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Jay Thiemeyer speaks with Portland writer Smith Henderson about his highly praised novel, 4th of July Creek. Set in Montana, the story explores the complexities of freedom, community, grace, and suspicion, and anarchy. That's all coming up, but first it is Press Watch at 9 o'clock with Teresa Mitchell. Hear the news you're not supposed to know. That is coming up next on KABU.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Pop Now 2014. From Friday, July 18th until Sunday, July 20th, PDX Pop Now will host bands on two stages, celebrating and supporting all ages music in the city of Portland, with bands such as The Bugs, The Portland Cello Project, The Estranged, Purse Candy, Orchestra Pacific Tropicale, Summer Cannibals, and many more. PDX Pop will take place at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Avenue in Portland. More information about PDX Pop Now 2014 can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. The Arctic is burning. An article published by Brian Kahn in Climate Central says that for the past few weeks, dry and warm weather have fueled large forest fires across Canada's remote Northwest Territories. The extent of those fires is well above average for the year to date and is in line with climate trends of more fires burning in the northern reaches of the globe. Of the 186 wildfires in the Northwest Territories to date this year, 156 of them are currently burning. That includes the Birch Creek Fire Complex, which stretches over 250,000 acres. The amount of acres burned in the Northwest Territories is six times greater than the 25-year average to date, according to data from the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center. Boreal forests like those in the Northwest Territories are burning at rates unprecedented in the past 10,000 years, according to the authors of a study put out last year. The northern reaches of the globe are warming at twice the rate as areas closer to the equator in those hotter conditions are contributing to more widespread burns. That's an article by Brian Conan. Departing from that article, speaking for myself, this, of course, is increasing the amount of soot in the air in the Arctic regions. Soot is melting glaciers, is melting the caps. Soot is the polar ice caps. Soot is melting Greenland, and that's what they're talking about when they say that there is less albedo, reflectivity of the ice. The ice absorbs more heat when it's got soot sticking to it, and that contributes to fires, which contribute more soot. And as I've been saying in the recent couple of years. I believe we are, unfortunately, past the trigger point for this phenomenon, which will get worse and worse. Returning to the article by Brian Kahn in Climate Central, the combined boreal forests of Canada, Europe, Russia, and Alaska account for 30% of the world's carbon stored in land, carbon that's taken up centuries to store. Forest fires like these currently raging in the Northwest Territories, as well as ones in 2012 and 2013 in Russia, can release that stored carbon into the atmosphere and contribute to global warming. Warmer temperatures can in turn create a feedback loop, priming forests for wildfires that release more carbon into the atmosphere and cause more warming. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Landmark Climate Report, released earlier this year, indicates that for every 1.8 Fahrenheit degrees rise in temperature, wildfire activity is expected to double. In addition, soot from forest fires can also darken ice in the Arctic and melt it faster. The 2012 fires in Siberia released so much soot that they helped create a shocking melt of Greenland's ice sheet. And once again, departing from the text, when you hear that there was a melt of Greenland's ice sheet, don't assume that it all went away. It is miles thick in places, and it's tremendous. And what happened was that the entire surface of it at one point, according to satellite measurements, was melted. Shocking enough. Bad enough, but there's, of course, a great deal of ice still in Greenland. And if there were not, Florida would be underwater. But returning to what is written here in Climate Central, over the course of a few weeks in July in 2012, 95% of the surface of Siberia melted. That could become a yearly occurrence by 2100 if temperatures continue to rise along with wildfire activity. Forests in other parts of the globe are also feeling the effects of climate change. In western U.S., wildfire seasons has lengthened by 75 days compared to 40 years ago. Additionally, rising temperatures and shrinking snowpack have helped drive an increase in the number of large forest fires. In Australia, fire danger is also increasing, if not the total number of fires, due to a similar trend of hotter, drier weather. Again, with my own comments, when you hear that this could be a problem by 2100, don't be fooled. That is scientists being conservative, as they will be and as they should be. That does not take into account the fact that we are observing an acceleration in the acceleration of climate change, of global warming. The disaster is on us, is the point I'm trying to make here. In related news, there is an outbreak in Africa of Ebola. And, of course, this is related to global climate change because of the stress on the animal populations and the appearance of zoonotic viruses. From Dakar, Senegal, the Boston Globe reports a total 539 deaths in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have now been attributed to the Ebola virus, the largest outbreak on record. Ebola has reached the capitals of all three countries. There are 44 new deaths, including 21 deaths, according to the World Health Organization reporting Friday. Ebola is a hemorrhagic fever that can cause its victims to bleed from the ears and nose, and it had never before been seen in this part of West Africa, where medical clinics are few and far between. The key to halting Ebola is isolating the sick, but fear and panic have sent some patients into hiding, complicating efforts to stop its spread. You can read more on that at BostonGlobe.com, and Doctors Without Borders says it fears the numbers of patients now being treated in Sierra Leone could be just the tip of the iceberg. Now turning to the situation on the U.S.-Mexico border, there is an article by David Bacon in These Times, which brings up some points, eight main points. And the first one is that there, and this article is an answer to the disinformation that is circulating about the children who have arrived penniless and in need on the border. First, there is no lax enforcement on the U.S.-Mexico border. Despite what you may have heard, there were over 20,000 Border Patrol agents. That number was as low as 9,821. There are walls in a system of huge centralized detention centers that didn't exist just 15 years ago. Now, more than 350,000 people spend some time in an immigration detention center every year. The U.S. spends more on immigration enforcement than all other enforcement activities of the federal government combined, including the FBI, the DEA, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The growing numbers of people in detention, young people as well as families and adults, is being used as a pretext by the anti-immigrant lobby in Washington, including the Tea Party and the Border Patrol itself, for demanding increases in the budget for enforcement. The Obama administration has given way before this pressure, but to repeat the first point, there is no lax enforcement. This is not happening because of lax enforcement. Second point, the migration of children and families didn't just start recently. It's been going on for a long time, although the numbers have recently surged. The tide of migration from Central America goes back to wars that the U.S. promoted in the 1980s, in which we armed the forces, governments, or contra forces, who were most opposed to progressive social change. Many hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans came to the U.S. during the late 1970s and 80s, to say nothing of Guatemalans and Nicaraguans. Whole families migrated, but so did parts of families, leaving loved ones behind, with the hope that someday they'd be reunited. Third point, the recent increase in the numbers of child migrants is not just a response to gang violence. Although this is the most cited cause in U.S. media coverage, migration is as much or more a consequence of the increasing economic crisis for rural people in Central America and Mexico, as well as the failure of these economies to produce jobs. People are leaving because they can't survive where they are. And speaking for myself, and just to add to that point, NAFTA has a lot to do with it. And the previous point, number two, that the oppressive regimes were supported by the U.S. powers that be, has everything to do with it, because they have destroyed the economies as well. Fourth point. The failure of Central America's economies is largely due to the North American and Central American free trade agreements and their accompanying economic changes, including privatization of business, the displacement of communities by foreign mining projects, and cuts in the social budgets. The treaties allowed huge U.S. corporations to dump corn and other agricultural products in Mexico and Central America, forcing rural families off their land when they could not compete. That's about corn, for example, in Mexico. Corn was dumped onto Mexico to the point that no one could afford to buy local corn. And then, of course, that market, that activity collapsed. Fifth point. When governments or people have resisted NAFTA and CAFTA, the United States has threatened reprisal. Right-wing Congressman Tom Tancredo of Colorado put forth a measure to cut off the flow of remittances, money sent back to Salvadoran families from family members working in the U.S., if the left-wing party, the FMLN, won the 2004 presidential election. How's that for democracy? His bill did not pass, but the U.S. Embassy in San Salvador admitted that it had intervened in the election. In 2009, the Honduran army overthrew President Manuel Zelaya after he raised the minimum wage, gave subsidies to small farmers, cut interest rates, and instituted free education. The Obama administration, which was furious, gave a de facto approval to the coup regime that followed. If social and political change had taken place in Honduras, we would see far fewer Hondurans trying to come to the U.S. Sixth point. Gang violence in Central America has a U.S. origin. Over the past two decades, young people from Central America have arrived in L.A. and big U.S. cities, where many were recruited into gangs, a story eloquently told by photographer Donna De Cesar in her recent book, Unsettled, Children in World of Gangs. The Maratrucha Salvadoreña gang, which today's newspaper stories hold responsible for the violence driving people from El Salvador, was organized in Los Angeles, not in Central America. U.S. law enforcement and immigration authorities responded to the rise of gang activity here with a huge program of deportations. The U.S. has been deporting approximately 400,000 people per year since 2009. Seventh point. Moreover, U.S. foreign policy in Central America has actively led to the growth of gang violence there. Eighth point. Kids looking for families here are looking for those who are already displaced by war and economic crisis. The separation of families is a cause of much of the current migration of young people. Young people fleeing the violence are reacting to the consequence of policies for which the U.S. government is largely responsible, the only way open to them. So you can find that at inthesetimes.org. Now about the situation in Gaza. Interesting article in commondreams.org by Ali Abunima. Oh, by the way, you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. And Per Fagering's coming up next at 9:30. And he will be talking about Afghanistan and related topics. The article by Ali Abunima says reports in Israeli and Palestinian media say that two Palestinian resistance groups, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, have set forth 10 conditions for a ceasefire and a 10-year truce with Israel. Israel's Ma'ariv says that unnamed senior Palestinian official passed it a copy of the demands, which have been transmitted by the factions to Egypt. They include a demand, they include an end to all armed hostilities, the end of the siege of Gaza, and the construction of the internationally supervised air and seaports. While Hamas has not as yet officially stated these demands, they are in line with the group's longstanding policy of offering Israel a multi-year truce. And these reported conditions come after 9 days of Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip, killing more than 200, injuring around 1,400, destroying homes of 8,000. 80% of the dead, who include more than 30 children, are civilians, according to the UN. And here are the 10 conditions. First condition, mutual cessation of the war, withdrawal of tanks to previous locations and return of farmers to work their land in agricultural border areas. Second, release of all the Palestinians detained since the 23rd of June 2014 and improvement of the conditions of Palestinian prisoners, especially prisoners from Jerusalem, Gaza, and Palestinians of the interior, meaning present-day Israel. Third, total lifting of the siege of Gaza and opening the border crossings to goods and people and allowing in all food and industrial supplies and construction of a power plant sufficient to supply all of Gaza. Fourth, construction of an international seaport and an international airport supervised by the UN and non-biased countries. Fifth, expansion of the maritime fishing zone to 10 kilometers, just 6 miles, and supplying fishermen with larger fishing and cargo vessels. Sixth point, converting the Rafah crossing, that's the only one that, that's the only non-Israeli crossing, goes into Egypt, and into an international crossing under the supervision of the UN and Arab and friendly countries. Seventh point, signing a 10-year truce agreement and deployment of international monitors to the borders. Eighth, a commitment by the occupation government not to violate Palestinian airspace and easing of conditions for worshippers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ninth, occupation will not interfere in the affairs of Palestinian government and will not hinder national reconciliation. Tenth, restoration of the border industrial areas and their protection and development. So how frightening is that? Not, is it? Didn't say anything that shouldn't already be happening. So when you hear that the Palestinians are difficult, just remember that those 10 points were very basic. And you didn't just hear anything. It would not be simply returning to a standard of international human rights and humaneness. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. A quote from Dr. Rami Abdu, chair of the independent group Euro Mid Observer for Human Rights, speaking to the Electronic Intifada, said, "I believe that these requirements should have been met years ago. The core of these requirements is not political, but merely purely humanitarian and legally binding. The international community has called many times for their implementation. Palestinians have the right to move in and out freely like others in the world. They have the right to import and export to control their borders and airspace. Israel argues that it left Gaza, so it should stop controlling the lives of Palestinians." Abdu noted that his organization recently published a detailed proposal to establish a maritime link from Gaza to the rest of the world with an international role that could alleviate security concerns. And that you can find that list and comments, pardon me, at electronicintifada.net. And as soon as you bring up electronicintifada.net, you better believe that you're going to be tracked by interested parties. Time is 9:19. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. A federal watchdog is suing a collection agency that allegedly operated like a factory, churning out lawsuits against cash-strapped borrowers, often using misleading, deceptive, and illegal practices. The suit is the latest effort by regulators to crack down on debt collection abuse. The billion-dollar industry has ballooned in size over the past two decades and is under fire for filing wrongful lawsuits against vulnerable borrowers. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau announced on Monday that it had sued Frederick J. Hanna and Associates, a Georgia-based law firm that sues consumers for old outstanding debts owed to banks, debt buyers, and credit card companies. The complaint against Hanna and Associates alleges that the firm operated as a lawsuit factory, cranking out more than 350,000 suits in Georgia alone since 2009. What's more, the company operates with a skeleton staff of 8 to 16 lawyers who merely put their signature on lawsuits, while the bulk of the work of the firm is performed by automated processes and non-attorney staff, according to the CFPB complaint. Now, departing from this article, a lot of you, a great number of you, have encountered this sort of sleazy collection activity, and I urge you to fight it. I urge you to pull up a search engine and look up the Debt Resistors Operations Manual. Debt Resistors Operations Manual. And you will find a great deal of information that will allow you to fight back instead of just being a victim of bottom feeders like this who buy debt in bulk for pennies on the dollar, and who make a tremendous profit by intimidating consumers into rolling over for their, well, in this case, lawsuits and various collection efforts. Often, the debts that they are trying to collect are not valid for various reasons. Sometimes the debts have actually been paid off. Doesn't matter. The information is duplicated. Someone buys it. They will file a suit against you, and you will have to pay. The court will force you to pay unless you confront them in court. And that's a terrifying idea, I know. But you actually can do it. You can find a lawyer if you work at it. I'm urging people to begin a fight back against this this 21st century phenomenon of debt predators. And once again, that's the Debt Resistors Operations Manual. Look it up, please. Download it. Read every word, because that will give you a great deal of empowerment. Now, returning to the article, in 2009 and 2010, the suit claims a single lawyer at the company signed off on about 138,000 lawsuits, an average of about 1,300 a week. Such a feat would seem to test the limits of physical endurance. We're talking about a smoking big pen here, but returning to the text, the firm's lawyers were expected to spend less than a minute looking at each lawsuit before signing it, the suit contends. The CFPB complaint names the law firm's president, Frederick Hanna, and two of the company's managing partners. It is asking for the firm to be fined, for its victims to be compensated, and for an injunction against the company and its partners. The website for Hanna and Associates, which was founded in 1981, describes the company as a law firm dedicated exclusively to creditors' rights and recoveries. Although the agency also has offices in Florida and Missouri, CFPB spokesperson Maura Vai told Huffington Post, the agency's lawsuit focuses on the firm's alleged activity in Georgia. Hanna and Associates managing partner Joseph C. Cooling said in a statement that the firm strongly denies the allegations, quote, "Our law firm takes great pride in its commitment to compliance with all consumer protection laws and takes great pains every day to ensure compliance with state civil procedure and evidentiary laws step by step," end quote, he said, and was shortly struck by lightning. Okay, I made that part up. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187. Businesses hire debt collection firms like Hanna and Associates to recover delinquent debts from consumers. It's most often credit card debt. but can include things like old cell phones or utility bills. The collection firms are typically paid a fee or a percentage of the debts they successfully collect. Hanna and Associates clients include high-profile banks like Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, Capital One, and Discover, the federal lawsuit says. Bank of America and Discover declined to comment. The other banks did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Vahey said the probe is ongoing. The Bureau is still collecting evidence and will continue to do so as the case proceeds through its court system. So good news there. And you can find much more information on that at Huffington Post. The Presbyterian Church on Friday became the most prominent religious group in the U.S. to endorse divestment as a protest against Israeli policies towards Palestinians, voting to sell church stock in three companies whose products Israel uses in the occupied territories. The church's General Assembly meeting in Detroit voted by 310-303 to sell stock in Caterpillar, Hewlett-Packard, and Motorola Solutions. 2 years ago, the Assembly rejected a similar divestment proposal by two votes. The American Jewish Committee, a policy and advocacy group based in New York, said the vote was driven by hatred of Israel. But Heath Redda, moderator for the church meeting, said immediately after the vote, then in no way is this a reflection of our lack of love for our Jewish brothers and sisters. The decision is expected to reverberate beyond the 1.8 million member church. It comes amid discouragement over failed peace talks that have left activists desperate for a way to effect change. And as the broader movement known as BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, has gained some momentum in the U.S., Israel's closest and most important ally. Now departing from what is written here, and speaking for myself, you can find a list of the boycotted corporations by looking on Facebook for boycott, Israel boycott list. Use their search function. You'll find it that way. It includes, I was surprised to see, Penny's, Procter & Gamble, McDonald's, and, of course, Caterpillar. Now, there's a number of firms that are on the boycott list. Returning to the article, Presbyterians who advocated for divestment insisted their action was not part of their broader boycott movement. Israeli officials, along with many American Jewish groups, denounced the campaign as an attempt to delegitimize the Jewish state. This is printed in the Guardian.co.uk. Separately, the Assembly also voted to re-examine its support for a two-state solution. In a statement on its Facebook page, the Israeli embassy in Washington denounced it, saying it was shameful. Excuse me. Omar Barghouti, a co-founder of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, the BDS movement, praised the vote as a sweet victory for human rights. He said Presbyterian supporters of Palestinian rights have introduced divestment into the U.S. mainstream and have given Palestinians a real hope in the face of the relentless and intensifying cruelty of Israel's regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid. Representatives of the Presbyterian Socially Responsible Investment Arm told the national meeting in Detroit that their efforts to lobby the three companies for change had failed. Carol Hilkema of the Israel-Palestine Mission Network, a Presbyterian group that advocates for Palestinians and spearheaded the drive for divestment, said their action was modeled on the divestment movement to end apartheid in South Africa. The 2012 Assembly had endorsed a boycott of Israeli products made in the Palestinian territories. And finally, there's an article by Ellen Brown in, in commondreams.org, I believe. No, it was in Counterpunch, I'm sorry. Saying that there is a great deal of turmoil in the banking industry. Actually, there are several sources of information for that. And I want to comment generally that the international financial system is worthy of some careful examination at this time. She writes, the banks may have met their match in June as some equally powerful titans strode onto the stage. Investors led by BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, and PIMCO, the world's largest bond fund manager, have sued some of the world's largest banks for breach of fiduciary duty as trustees of their investment funds. The investors are seeking damages for losses surpassing, and here's the figure that should get your attention, $250 billion. That's the equivalent of 1 million homeowners with $250,000 in damages suing at one time. You can find more on that at counterpunch.org, which has a great great number of worthy articles. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Stay tuned because Parafoggering's coming up on the incredible Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. So you can find a podcast of this on the World Wide Web. And I'll be back next week. This goes out to you and everyone who's interested in change and to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio proudly co-sponsors the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on Thursday, July 17th from 6 p.m. until 1 a.m. at Holocene, located at 1001 Southeast Morrison. This fundraiser opens with an ocean art show and silent auction, followed by a screening of the surf film Seven Signs. Then the reggaetronic five-piece band Everyday Prophets takes center stage at 10 p.m. Again, that's the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on July 17th. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. Show is Fight the Empire. My name is Parafoggering, and we have a special guest, an old friend of ours, Zahir Wahab, who is a professor emeritus from Lewis and Clark, and he went back to Afghanistan, his native country, but he's back in town for a few weeks anyway, and we're really very happy to have him here telling us what's going on in Afghanistan. Zahir, welcome to KBOO again.
Good morning. Thank you. It's nice to be with you, Per.
Oh, it's just it's great to see you again.
Likewise.
We always thought you were gone for good or something.
Well, I was gone for